Ja, guten Woche. So ja, ein Travis Alvarez. Shara Bitochen, Perry Gdalin. In the middle of Perry Gdalin, we have our Perush Achelik HaShishi.
Okay, so that's on page 434.
Page 434 in the English. Yashukoyach. So here, if you remember, the broader context is that the Chavis HaLavas was moving through different areas of life, if we'll put it that way, different areas of life, and showing how we apply the subject of Bitachon to those areas of life. And now, he's up to the following. But Perush HaChelek HaShishi, the sixth area that we have to apply Bitachon to, is when it comes to reward for mitzvahs. To have bitachon in Hashem, to trust that Hashem will reward our mitzvahs, those that are rewarded in this world, those that are rewarded in the next world. Asher yeh ha'adam ro'u Elohim b'maisa ha'toiv ba'olam, that a person earns through his good choices. Now, hu she'agmul al shnei panim. Now, there are different types of variations when it comes to reward. Gmul bilvad. There is reward that's only in this world. There's reward that's only in the next world. Shneim, there are some behaviors or mitzvahs that earn a person reward in both worlds. The Torah did not elaborate on it in a way that provides us with full clarity on this. How did Hashem did not, when it, like, for example, when it comes to, what we'll see in a moment, when it comes to Averis, there's a very clear listing of what punishment is for what. When it comes to mitzvahs, it doesn't work that way. The way it's expressed in the Torah is that if you keep the Torah in general, everything will be good in general. The Torah doesn't say this mitzvah will get you this, that mitzvah will get you that. Hashem didn't break it down to different rewards for different forms of service at different times, right? Which he did do when it comes to Averis. Averis is a very clear listing of what Avera warrants which punishment. The Torah outlines the things that Shoisem, Chayavim, Skila, Sreifa, the whole list of punishments for different types of actions. Right? We have Skila, Sreifa, Herek, Chenek, Malkus, Misa, Kares, Teshul Mekefel, Teshul Avon, Mechamisha, Nezek, etc. There's all kinds of different penalties for all kinds of different Averis, depending on their severity. Some are monetary penalties, some are corporal penalties, etc. But we have a whole listing, we have a whole system of knowing exactly what Avera warrants what sort of punishment. Avogu.
David has got his car right away. He got his car, then he got Kahanut, and then he got his car right away. So what's going to happen when he gets stolen by car?
What's gonna happen when he gets stolen? Well, so his mitzvah was the type of mitzvah that earns you both, but it's not just that. I have to appreciate that his mitzvah, the schar that he got right away, really put him into a whole different place when it comes to schar, because now he was made now into a kohen, right? That was part of it. Kohen means that now he has that much more opportunity to be getting schar in Olam Haba, etc. Really, it was more than just schar. What Hashem did then wasn't schar. It was that his whole status changed. He became I won't use the word leader, but just to say it in simple terms, he went from being a non-Kayan to a Kayan, which basically changed the status of his seed for all of history because of the fact that he had taken this step. He had done a very great act of reconnecting Klal Yisrael with Hashem. Question.
If you do, well, I think we discussed this before. If you do a mitzvah, your kavana also counts into the reward you're going to get. If you do an avera, does your kavana also count into it? And are any of these that are listed based only on thought? I mean, it looks to me like all these things spelled out, you actually have to do an action. You can have thought a bad thought or thought of something. Is there any punishment listed out for that?
Oh, okay. So no, the Torah does not actually articulate punishments that relate to thoughts.
Come on.
That's right. And the point that you're raising actually is behind one of the explanations that he's going to give. So let's see. So he said, when it comes to averis, we have much more of a listing. Now, as you're pointing out, it's still not absolute. There are averis, we don't know what their punishment is. For example, everything from failing to, or neglecting, refusing to do a mitzvah to say that you had to do, right? Torah doesn't say any punishment. Anything from there to the wrong thoughts, et cetera, the Torah doesn't say punishment for those. So the Torah, above a certain level of severity, the Torah outlines the punishment. But it's true, when it comes to averus also, we don't have everything. Just that when it comes to mitzvahs, we don't have any delineation of what's for what. Very, I shouldn't say any. There are very singular instances of mitzvahs that Torah spells out the reward, but it's certainly far from being a rule, whereas with averus, it is the rule, right? But when it comes to the reward of Olam Haba and the punishment of Olam Haba, the Torah does not spell that out at all, for a number of reasons. So I'm not going to move, what I want to do now is I'm not going to move through the reasons inside. Some of them are more philosophical. I want to touch on a few of the main ones outside. This is a classic question of why does the Torah not speak of the reward of Olam Haba? Why is it that when the Torah describes a reward, it's always in material terms? Now, I want to just qualify the question a little bit, because sometimes the question is asked a little differently. The question is asked, why does the Torah not say anything about Olam Haba? Why doesn't Olam Haba appear in the Torah? Now, the answer to that is that it does, just in subtle form. There are references to Olam Haba in the Torah, quite a number of references. The Gemara points some of them out. If you want one of the most explicit ones, the Kozari points this out, is Bilam's declaration. Of Bilam says, Tamais nafshi moisi sharon v'teyat musi kamayim. That's it. If you really analyze that statement, it should fill you with a thrill. But Bilam is having his vision, and he's seeing, you know, the destiny of the Jewish people and what Hashem has in mind for them. He gives us like this yearning cry. He says, "Ay, if only I could die the death of the righteous." All those righteous, talking about the Bnei Yisrael. If only I could die their death and have their what they have coming to them afterwards. And he saw it and he went out of his mind and he expressed it with this yearning plea. So that is one of the most explicit references to the fact that there is Olam Haba. There are others also, other allusions. But, so the question is not, why don't we see anything about Olam Haba in the Torah? That's not the question. The question is, why doesn't the Torah elaborate? Why doesn't the Torah give us more of an idea of what earns you what? So, and again, to fully round out the question, why does the Torah, yes, spell it out in material terms, right? That the Torah does do. The Torah gives you all kinds of descriptions of material bracha that you'll get for keeping the Torah. So, like I said, we're not going to do it inside, but we're going to touch on a few of his tirutzim outside, the ones that I think were more resonate with us where we are. We might divide this over 2 weeks, but what I first want to do is actually show how this question and the answer to this question is actually quite time appropriate. We're in 3 weeks now, and the 3 weeks is a confusing kind of time, meaning it could be a couple of different kinds of times. It can be a kind of time of basically nothing, meaning so disconnected that there are ways of working with all the emotions, forget about. As far as the technical restrictions goes, there are ways with dealing with all of them. You can deal with all of them, right? Music, So there's plenty of all kinds of things you can do to not lose the effect of music while kind of keeping the halacha, from a cappella to all these other things. And of course, you know, we're all familiar with the advertisements that come out. Who said that fish can't be just as good as meat, right? All the gorgeous restaurant 9-day advertisements of the amazing fish menus, etc. So, you know, we can make the we can get through the 3 weeks and the 9 days kind of painlessly. But you know what? That is actually, would actually be pronouncing quite how far we've drifted. I'm talking about as from Jews. In terms of Hashem Kiviyachol, it's going to be completely one-sided, that Hashem is painting over the distance between us. But Baruch Hashem, we would figure out how to work it out. We certainly don't want to be in that place. But let's talk from a little bit of from a more conscientious place. The 3 weeks, if you'll agree with me, if you don't, then I envy you, meaning maybe you're not in this place. But very often for the conscientious people, the 3 weeks are more of a, let's say, like a stressful, guilty kind of time than a sad time. Because if I tell you, okay, listen, right now I'd like you to be devastated, okay? Please, you know, actually, you know, we could start another half a minute, okay? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, then, okay, be devastated, please, feel devastated. It doesn't really work, right? You can't command emotions, and certainly, if I like tell you, you know, there was a really special person who died at some point in the 1600s. Aren't you heartbroken? You're not? Well, I'd like you to be. Please be heartbroken right now. Okay, it really was a wonderful person. I never knew the person. I have no connection with the person. Avelus really only comes from something that you lost, that you had a very close connection with. We have a connection with Hashem today. It's not like we don't have a connection. Beis HaMikdash, it's very hard to feel devastated. We were born into the post-Beis HaMikdash Yiddishkeit. So what ends up happening for many of the conscientious is that we want to feel sad. We don't feel sad. We're trying to figure out how to feel sad. And that just kind of creates just this certain like tension or guilt or what am I supposed to do with this time exactly? And then, you know, you kind of move past it when it's finally over. Okay, but at least now I'm not supposed to feel sad anymore. We can move on. So the truth is that this question, why doesn't Hashem spell out the schar of Olam Haba, kind of actually in the Kuzari, the Chavis HaVavis alludes to this subtly, actually gives us a whole Pesach, a whole opening to yes, connecting with what's going on in this time period. So I'm going to move down. And I'm going to see what the Chavis HaVavis says. It, this is often like that when you learn the very fundamental Sfarim of the Kadmonim. Chavis HaVavis, Kuzari, the Ramchal. One elaborates on what the other alluded to. And bring it all together, you get a very rich picture. So I'm going to move to one of the answers that the Chavis HaVavis gives. He leaves it a little bit cryptic. And then we'll talk about the Kuzari's elaboration on it. And I personally found that this really gave me much more of a connection to what's going on now, to appreciate this time as a time of really creating closeness with Hashem. The kind of closeness that comes from distance, meaning sometimes dafka, being distant from somebody, is what really brings out the feelings of sometimes of somebody you love. And when you're with them day in, day out, 24 hours, seven, so sometimes you forget that you love them. And davka, being apart, is what often brings out those real feelings of fondness. Right? It's a famous English expression, no? Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? And familiarity breeds contempt. Mm-hmm. So I'm moving down to one of the last explanation of the Chavis HaVavis. I'm going to read it briefly inside and then elaborate a bit. So one of the reasons why the Torah does not elaborate on the Schar of Olam Haba, right? You know, the Lahavdil, Elef Alfei Havdalos, other religions give you a very clear menu. So he says, Mehem, one of the reasons is, Shegmula Olam Haba Ein tachlisai elali dovig belekim, at least karev el oilei oilei elyon. The reward of Olam Haba is not that you get this and you get that. The bliss of Olam Haba is being connected with Hashem, being bound up with Him, and being brought all the way up close to His great light. I'm skipping a few words. And the essence of this really is the person who Hashem cherishes, experiencing being drawn close to Hashem because He cherishes you. That is the schar of Olam Haba. And being held close by Hashem because He cherishes you and wants you close to Him. Now, you hear that and you say, okay, fine, that does sound beautiful, but after an hour, what do I do? And then 2 hours, and then 3 hours, Hashem is closing, holding me close because He cherishes me. So how does that work, you know, for a day, 2 days, a week, a year, a million years? Hashem is holding me close because He cherishes me. And the understanding, the answer to that is, in a way that we're not really going to connect with in our bodies, but and that's part of the purpose of this point, is that that's why the Torah could not really describe the Schar of Olam Haba, because actually, being bound up with Hashem in that state is the greatest pleasure and ecstasy that doesn't die down, greater than anything we've ever experienced. And unlike Olam Hazeh, where things get boring after a while, where you grow accustomed to something, Olam Haba doesn't have those confines. Something that is thrilling at the first moment stays just as thrilling after 10 years and after 50 years and after 100 years. It doesn't die down at all. So he says, that being brought close to Hashem, Hashem being pleased with you and wanting you close to Him, that is the essence of the reward. Again, I'm skipping a few words. The Omar beParshas in Bechukosai. Now, in the parsha of Bechukosai, where Hashem describes the material rewards that you'll get for keeping the mitzvahs, if you're reading it carefully, so there are remazim shemoyrim al rotzem elikim. There are different statements. Those seem like not really the main thing. The main thing is that you'll have plenty, and there will be peace, and there won't be sword in your land, etc. But then there are those words that just look like, you know, perspective, but those are actually really the essence of it all. Hashem says, I won't be repulsed by you. Sounds like a strange promise. If you're going to be very great, I won't be repulsed by you. But you know what? It really is. But before we get back to that, yeah, question.
When you're talking about Olam Haba for our souls, are we talking about after Mashiach or this world?
It
sounds like
Hijab. So we're talking about Olam Haba for our souls, when we're talking about Olam Haba, right now at the moment, right? And what do you mean when you say that he jumped?
It sounded like we were saying, you know, that he'll be peace in the land, and I don't remember all the different parts, but yeah, cheerio. That's this world.
Right. Good. Okay. So we're going to let's finish reading it. And then the point that you make, this is really where the Kuzari comes in. And that's what I'm really leading up to. So he says, yes, there's a whole bunch of different material things that are listed there, right? You'll have to empty out the storehouses because of all the new things that are coming in, etc., right? I won't be repulsed by you. I'll turn to you. Now, when we read that pasuk, it goes, I'll turn to you and I'll increase you and I'll enhance you. So we say, I'll turn to you is like a technicality. And then I'll increase, I'll enhance you. That's where the emphasis is. But actually, in the spiritual level, I'll turn to you. That is really the thrilling part of the pasuk. Hashem is going to turn His focus on you and be focused on you lovingly. The symptoms of that are going to be, there's going to be a lot of food. But that's not really the heart of the experience. The heart of the experience is experiencing in a tangible way Hashem's loving focus. I will be your God and you will be my nation. Now, we hear that, we say, okay, well, yeah, that's the reality. I mean, he's our God. I mean, we have to worship him. No. This means I will actively be focused on you, acting as your God in a very active way. Let's try to, up till now, this is a little abstract. Let's move it. Let's transition into the Kuzari and see how, what's really the depth behind this. The Kuzari says it as follows. He says it in a much more blunt kind of way. He says, you know why the Torah does not describe Olam Haba? Because instead the Torah told you, how can you, he says, he only almost makes fun of, he says, what kind of business is it to just promise a person that it'll all be after death and not give him something that he can actually experiment with now? So the Kuzari says that actually the Torah is telling you how you can connect to Olam Haba in this world. In the Brachas of Bechukosai, the Torah is telling you, here I'm giving you the means of experiencing the ultimate. What do we mean by that? So what we mean by that is as follows. He says, just the we don't appreciate what it really means to be living in a reality, in the open Shechina, as they did in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash. Living with an open Shechina was a whole different quality of life. It was a level of life that we've never experienced and we can't imagine, but we're going to make an attempt to try to connect to a little bit. But in terms of quality of life, and I mean Olam Hazeh, the life that we have today is dull is not the word. To say that it is mamish, it's like the plug is out. This is not the Olam Hazeh that Hashem intended. The way it's expressed by the Kuzari is the qualitative difference between the Jewish life in the time of the Mishnah and Jewish life afterwards is the difference between a dry bone and a live body. We today are experiencing a dead Olam Hazeh, a dead Yiddishkeit. Now, we know Yiddishkeit to be something very rich, but that's all relevant. That's all because this is Yiddishkeit we were born into. But in terms of what it was when the Shekhinah was throbbing and pulsing in our lives in a very intimate, real kind of way, in very material terms, you were talking about enjoying life to a much, much greater extent. Let's try to bring this out a little bit. Just try to act and make this a little tangible if we can. I'll go from two angles. One angle is Nevuah. The Kuzari talks about this. He says that Nevuah was actually experiencing Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba in this world. It was the most ecstatic experience that a person could possibly have in this world. We think of Nevuah, again, reading back, it just kind of seems like a technicality. Hashem has a message to give, taps someone on the shoulder and says, can you please tell everybody XYZ? He says, no, Nevuah was an experience of such immense power that we know the Nevi'im fell down. They couldn't stay, other than Moshe Rabbeinu, the Nevi'im couldn't handle it in a physical way. They fell to their feet, they went into a certain state, because what was actually happening was they were being hit with a charge that was too much for the body to handle. And the experience was so intense that afterwards, when the Navi came to afterwards, he couldn't enjoy anything else of Olam Hazeh after that. Any kind of bliss that you gave him paled in comparison with those moments of the Nevuah. And the rest of his life, he spent waiting for, will I ever get such an experience again? There's no time in anything after that. And Memela, the Kuzari, says that these people, you didn't have to promise them things after death. They had already experienced what it was like. This is what it's going to be. It was almost like they were looking forward to it. After they experienced that taste of Olam Haba, they were looking forward to it. Now, we've already learned in the Chavis of Avis how the person who really appreciates Olam Haba, on the one hand, is looking forward. On the other hand, is trying to delay it because he knows that every extra moment can enhance it that much more. But he says, these people didn't need to be consoled. Don't worry, after death, things will be, there's still going to be a continuation. These people had already experienced it, and they were anxiously waiting for it. And he goes, says even more than that. He says that just a vicarious experience. If a person was standing by when he saw a Navi get Nevuah, that itself changed the person for life. A person who was looking, he saw. This is very common. Sometimes you might naturally be experiencing something, but you see the intensity of emotions on the other person, it can actually send a shudder through you, right? So watching a Navi get Nevuah, you are actually seeing something of such a charge that you realize that it changed you. It changed you forever. Now, that's still a little bit over our heads. Let's try to bring it home a little bit more, because Nevuah was really just one. What about the people who weren't Nevi? So let's understand that the Nevuah was the epitome of a certain reality, but that reality pervaded all of Eretz Yisrael. Every person, the simplest person, was experiencing it, not to that extent, but in other ways that we'll describe now. First of all, let me just stress, Nevuah was something that anybody could work toward. We know about 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'is, but those are only the ones whose Nevuah was needed for all of posterity. It had to be recorded for all of posterity. But actually, there were 1.2 million Nevi'im throughout the period when Nevuah was in effect, which means that people worked toward it and achieved it. There were I don't know if we call it courses, yeshivas for working toward it, right? It was called the B'nai HaNevi'im. There were systems for training toward getting Nevuah. It was a very, very intense business. You had to reach very, very high spiritual levels, but they worked on it in a very focused, intense kind of way. And you had people who got to it where they got it on a more regular basis, people who got it once or twice in their lifetime, and that was the highlight of their lifetime. I think I've mentioned here that I once tried to make a very rough calculation of taking into account the amount of Deiris. It was about 800 years. The period of Nevuah, approximately, a little more. And just trying to take 1.2 million and divide it up, kind of try to divide it, it came out approximately in a very rough way that there was a Navi every few buildings. If we're talking in contemporary terms, there was a Navi every few buildings, which means that you lived on, I don't know, Dolev or wherever, you were crossing paths on a regular basis with 10 Nevi'im. You needed a Navi to go to, so if the one three buildings that way wasn't home, you went to the one who was, you know, you had to go a little further, right? You had to go over the hill. And that was Nevuah. That was the peak of it. But let's talk about the not peak of it. And we'll bring this home as follows. Hashem was busy interacting with people in their regular lives in all kinds of ways. And this really is the significance of when we hear the material levels, the greatness of the fruit of Eretz Yisrael, the greatness of the produce of Eretz Yisrael. So you think, so it's about that? It's like, you know, when the Ramban was weeping, longing to come to Eretz Yisrael his whole life. What was it? Because he tasted a fig in Spain and he said, it's not the real thing. Go to Eretz Yisrael, there, a fig is a fig. That was what he was weeping for his whole life. That was what he was longing for. That was what he ended up making the push and coming to Eretz Yisrael with such sacrifice. When we hear the descriptions of the figs, what's the significance of it? What's really behind all that is the experience of Hashem pampering you. And that was really the thrill of it. That was really what turned life into a whole different experience. It was open. Today, Emuna, we work on our Emuna, we work on Avas Hashem, we work on Tefillah, but it's so delicate to really have that sense of connection, of a real dynamic between us and Hashem. It's effort, it's delicate, it's easily lost. I imagine that there are people here in this room who are on a higher level than me in that regard and probably do experience it more intensely on a more ongoing basis. I say that seriously. But in a general way, it's delicate, it's subtle. In those days, it wasn't. It was natural, it was there, it was overpowering because Hashem's love was actively showering over you. It wasn't that something you had to work so hard to connect to? Because he was right there, because he wasn't waiting at a distance to see, will you be reaching out to him? So for example, the Gemara tells us that in the days of the second Beis HaMikdash, wheat berries grew to the size of kidneys. Now, a wheat berry, you know what a wheat berry looks like? So I'm just like, what's that? Like barley. Like, so as a man, I always assumed that barley is the size it looks like when it's in your chalet. Yeah. But then one day I walked into the kitchen on Friday, I discovered barleys are actually much smaller than that, yeah. Right? It's like barley, that's what it is. This big, right? A kidney is about this big, something like this. So this is what wheat berries look like. Now, again, I tell you that, and I say, so now you are like just longing for the return of the Shekhinah Tzion, so that if today it takes 300 barleys to fill a challah plate, can you imagine that when Mashiach comes, ten will be plenty. Now, have I turned you on? Have I like really? No, but let's understand what's really the significance behind it. Significance behind it is as follows. Imagine, and by the way, this was in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, which was already called. Oh, that's right. Second Beis HaMikdash was with the lights off. It was with the plug out. The first, that's what the Gros says, like we saw it from the Kuzari, the difference between the vitality of Yiddishkeit, of the Jewish life, between the first Beis HaMikdash and the second was like a live body versus a dead one after the destruction. There was a tiny drop left at the very beginning. There were a handful of Nevi'im left, and they were nifter at the beginning of that period, and that was that. The Beis HaMikdash Sheni, you have to realize it was really the first stage of the Gullus. People don't necessarily realize that. It was the lights were turning off rapidly and was basically setting us up for the Gullus. So you have to think of it in the following terms. Imagine you have a couple and they don't treat each other as they ought to. And they both decide we're going to work on it. Okay? They work on it. They're working very hard. And they also have a field. They have a field. And he's working hard. She's working hard. They're both putting in a lot of effort. And they're overcoming their midas. And they're watching the way they talk. And et cetera, making all those efforts. And every year they have a crop. They have their usual wheat berries. And as the winter is moving along, they're seeing how the wheat berries, they grew to the regular size. But this was a winter that they really put in much, much more spiritual effort than they usually did. And the Navi told them that. The Navi told them that this is what Hashem wants you to be investing your efforts in now. And they see that as the wheat berries are starting to grow, they're not stopping. They're not stopping. They're continuing to grow. Now they're the size of a cranberry. That's much bigger than a wheat berry, right? And now they're the size of an olive. Now they're the size of a plum. And they're just continuing to grow and grow and grow until they grow to the size of kidneys. This is not about, wow, I have a wheat berry the size of a kidney. This is about seeing Hashem in our life, stroking, giving me a stroke on the cheek as I'm making efforts, patting me on the back, giving me his kiss, showing me his smile. And that's why when they went out to those fields, they just started crying, right? When they came out and saw those wheat berries, when the person who was working on Shmiras Halashim went out to his vineyard and saw basketball-sized grapes, he saw Hashem telling him, I'm proud of you. This is what was going on in regular life. And this is what's behind when the Torah says, you'll have peace. It doesn't mean, oh, you'll have the benefit of no war. It means you're going to see Hashem standing over Eretz Yisrael, saying, these are my children, you keep back. You get a little too close, you get electrocuted. And living under that protection in a live kind of way. So it's not about, when the Bnei Yisrael saw Sancheiriv's mighty army in one night, I forgot the number now, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, all of them struck dead. It wasn't just about the relief. It was about, whoa, Hashem was waiting. Come a little closer, right? And then boom. It was the thrill, right? After that, the whole world was in awe. It says that after that, a Jew who went anywhere else in the world was worshipped. We're not into that. But the pagans were. This is what we were experiencing, was that pride. You know the way it worked before in the Bayis Rishon, what a war looked like. It was simply walking behind Hashem, right? I just remember my when we were growing up in Brooklyn, there was always the bullies on the block. They didn't like the little Jewish boys. And we always had the bullies on the block who used to pick on us, start up with us, etc. And most of the fathers on the block were also like timid and, wanted to avoid trouble and this and that. So my father was like something of a figure he came from Eretz Yisrael and didn't go for all this business, and he was raised rough. And his shita was, they have to be scared. And it was often like we were certain celebrities, even though we really were like the biggest weaklings from among our friends. But there was a certain, like we were celebrities in that sense that if things got rough, he would come out and we'd all be standing there while he would go after them. As I say, and there were many such scenes until it reached a point where we walked by the bullies and they would say, no, his father's stuff. So there was that pride. It wasn't just that we weren't being started up with. It was that pride. Now, if something would happen Shabbos afternoon, and we would wake my father up from his nap, and he would get up groggy and irritated and head out of the house. And they'd all go scattering. You know, we'd be walking behind him like all proud. This is what the experience of going out to war was like. We went out to war. Let's distinguish. We already discussed the difference between the first base of Mikdash and the second, but I want to distinguish that from the time of the second base of Mikdash, you know that before the Malachim, there wasn't an organized army. In the time of the Shoftim, time of the Shoftim is one of the most misunderstood and unappreciated tkufas in Tanakh. Looks like it took them 400 years to get their act together until they found the organized things. That's so far from the truth. A nation that's just in Balagan mode doesn't survive for 400 years. It was an unbelievable period where they did not have a central government. Why? Because the Shmuel expressed that they lived directly under Hashem's reign and they were able to handle that. They didn't have there was no organized government, right? The Shoftim were haphazard, one from there, one from there. There wasn't an organized government in place. There wasn't an organized enforcement system in place. There wasn't an organized army. It was when the Jewish people couldn't handle that precarious existence 400 years into it, when they said, we just can't handle this anymore. We need a king. We need to know that there's an army in place. And that was considered a big failing. But how did wars work up till then? The way wars worked up till then, look at the description of Devaira, in the times of Devaira. Get together a bunch of people, put up signs in the shuls. Our boy said there's going to be a war tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Anybody who can come, please come. And if you can bring forks or shtenders or things like that with you, please bring whatever you can bring. Look at the Mefarshim there. You see, it talks about Seferim going out with their quills. Okay? They came up against Sisera's army, trained warriors, with swords and spears, and the Seferim went out with their quills. They had my build. Okay? They went out with their quills. And what happened? It says, this is an expression that was used throughout the time of the Shoftim and wasn't used again afterwards, once the Malachim came about. Then in the times of the Malachim also, the battles were miraculous. But in the times of the Shoftim, it was just officially such that there was no semblance of war afterwards. David said, we have to start teaching people how to use weapons. We reached that point in history. But it says, the term, it shows up in a number of the battles before the Malachim was Vayaham Hashem. Hashem just confounded them. This was a phenomenon of the Jewish people went out in a ragtag kind of way. And the way Devar expressed it was, you know, Barak, right? Barak ben Avinoyam put together the army when Devar was facing off against Sisera. So he gathered people from Kedesh, Naphtali, whatever, a bunch of people. And they're facing off, the two armies are facing off against each other. And Devar yells at Barak, you have to get moving quickly. You know why? Because Hashem is already at war and you have to keep up with Hashem. It was almost like the other way around, not that they're attacking, but Hashem already started, so you have to be out there. And they went over and running along, and Hashem is knocking over the enemy as they're arriving. They weren't even doing the killing. So this was Hashem moving ahead of the army, and smiting and killing, and yeah, a soifer waves his quill, and here's a big, huge warrior in armor, and you know, with the big spear and the shield. The story of David and Goliath was a regular occurrence. That was how wars worked in those days. In David's time, it was already a chiddush because there was already a king, and there was already an army. But this was all the experience of the Jewish people living with Hashem in an open way. To circle back, so the Kuzari says, and this experience was a thrilling experience. People were living with that warmth of seeing Hashem involved with them on the national and personal level in such an intimate way, Nevi'im all over the place, but even besides the Nevi'im, seeing it on your tree, in your vineyard, in your home, in your flocks, seeing Hashem popping up here, popping up there, stroking you on the cheek, patting you on the back, giving you his kiss, smiling at you. That was, Hashem didn't have to talk about Olam Haba. That's the Kuzari's point. Hashem didn't have to talk about Olam Haba. Once you've really tasted open closeness with Hashem, you already knew what it meant. You already knew what to expect. You didn't need those promises. Hashem says, after you die, I'm going to take you to the next level, but you already know what we're talking about. And if you're a Navi, you actually got to the full level. So the Kuzari says, that's why it's not that Hashem didn't describe it. Hashem did describe it. When Hashem said, keep the mitzvahs and you will enjoy all this plenty, Hashem was actually telling you, this is how you will experience Olam Haba in this world. You already know what we're talking about. And that's what the Chayim Sabava says here, much more bekitzer. He says it much more in short and cryptically, but he says that the real significance behind the material promises, the essence behind it, the heart of it is, the experience of Hashem drawing you close, of Hashem showing you his love for him. And that, so it actually is laid out in the Torah, just not in a way we can appreciate. And you know what? Here's where we come back to the tkufa we're in now. This is what we are missing. This is what we're hoping to get back. This is what Hashem is telling us. I yearn for that period where we mamish live together in that intimate kind of way. It pains me that we're not there today. It pains me that I'm at more of a distance and you have to work so hard to connect to me subtly. And I give these little flashes of connection. We can appreciate Hashem connecting up with us today also. I'm sure everybody here in the room has experienced it. A feeling Hashem showing you that he's there. But it's so much more subtle. It's so much less blatant. And on the contrary, that should create for us that longing of Pashat seeing it, where Emunah is not a thing that we work toward. That's our reality. The question is, what do we do with it? What do we do with? Are we going to live up to having Hashem in our lives in such a powerful, open kind of way? This is what we're missing. This is what we're hoping to get back to, Be'ezus Hashem. And if we can, what we can do, our part, is to sense this to whatever extent we can and feel like we want that closeness. If we develop in our sense the longing, so we have turned these 3 weeks into a very worthwhile period. If we come out of these 3 weeks longing, because there's such a difference in relationship between a parent and a child who are separated from each other, right? And the parent is constantly thinking about the child. The child moved on, right? The child moved on. The child's fine. And then you have the case where both are yearning for each other. Both are yearning for each other. It's the same physical distance. They're on two different continents. But here, there's a relationship that's actually growing stronger, right? And here, there's a relationship that's half dead. This is what we can accomplish in these times. This is a nachas that we can give Hashem in the sense that Hashem, we're longing for it also. It is mutual. You're longing to have that closeness with us. We're longing to have it with you. And we are pained over the fact that we don't have it. Then we've actually brought out, even if chas v'shalom, we're hoping that we'll actually see it get there before Tisha B'Av, before the Shabbos. But even if chas v'shalom not, we've accomplished that. We've accomplished bringing the relationship to that higher level. Halavai, we should be zeichet to see it reach the finish line. Yeah. To you.
We're living in time. There was a day when you wouldn't believe it. I didn't want to finish reading the article. They wrote an article that in America, in Manhattan, opened up a restaurant that a hamburger was $125.